Immigration has become a major issue during this presidential election. The Republican Party's primaries were driven somewhat by the topic, and now that party has promised to curb what many Americans believe to be a problem with undocumented immigrants. In an article for The Nation called "Undocumented Immigrants Can't Vote, But They're Still Making Their Voices Heard," Michelle Chen explains the findings of James McCann and Michael Jones Correa on non-citizen political engagement in a study that they conducted for the Russell Sage Foundation Journal of Social Sciences. I'm very pleased it has brought Michelle Chen to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Is there more than one category of non-citizen?
Yeah, it's pretty much a catch-all phrase to cover asylum seekers, refugees, and those present in the country who might be here on temporary visas. So it could include a tourist visa, include someone here on a work visa. So everyone who's basically not a dyed-in-the-wool American citizen.
So they have varying degrees of legal status.
Legal status, and their terms in this country vary highly. So you might be in for a few months, you might be here as a student, or you might be here, sort of under the radar of the authorities.
And are they treated differently depending on their status?
Well, just in terms of what they're here for, if you have work authorization, that can make all the difference for people. So there are some people here on so-called guest worker programs, and they have temporary authorization to work legally in the United States. There are others, such as tourists, who cannot work, and there are other people who have come in perhaps under unlawful circumstances. They call it an unlawful entry, or they might have overstayed their visas. So you can have all sorts of varying levels of precarity while here. You could be deported at any minute, or you could just be living here.
And I assume legal residents have fewer worries about immigration policy than other non-citizen groups.
Yes. I mean, they're certainly less in danger of immediate deportation.
Does that mean they have a green card?
Yeah. I mean, legal permanent residency means you have a green card. There are other types of categories, such as asylum seekers and other folks with court cases pending, where they might have some authorization to be in this country. But overall, generally the safest place to be is if you're not native born, then it's as a naturalized citizen. But, not everyone wants that, and not everyone has access to that.
And I've spoken to a number of people I know who've lived in this country for many years and are not citizens, and they give me all sorts of reasons, including it's complicated, it costs more money than anybody imagined to become a citizen.
Yeah, and I think that gets to the heart of what we consider to be a citizen. I mean, a citizenship can get you the right to vote. It makes sure that, perhaps you have an easier time getting property, getting credit, and doing all sorts of things that, people who are here in the long term can do. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who never fully become citizens. They're just here on a green card, and they stay there for years and years, and they can own a home, they can work here, they can raise their kids here. Many of them have citizen children, but, they don't want to go through the rigmarole, don't want to have a test.
In fact, we have a situation where one of my staff is a citizen child. She says her father can't become a citizen because he owns property in India, and I didn't know that that was a reason you couldn't become a citizen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex kind of Byzantine latticework of laws and regulations that kind of work on both sides of the borders. I don't know what his home country situation is, but sometimes the home country may put some sort of restriction on how long you can be abroad. I know that if you're a student here, there might be all sorts of legal complications in terms of how long you're allowed to stay in this country, what will happen to your assets back home if you decide to just take off. So
I'm assuming that it's only estimates as to how many non-citizens live in the United States, since so many don't want us to know.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, non-citizen being a very broad category, that can include everyone who is completely undocumented, or it could just include a bunch of people who are here on tourist visas. So the non-citizen population is always in flux, much more so than the citizen population, and that's one of the big problems.
Immigration has become a major issue in Europe, but is the situation at all similar to what we're talking about here?
I would say so, yes. I mean, the images that we've been seeing come over the news, in terms of this mass wave of refugees and asylum seekers crossing over land borders to Europe. We don't see that phenomenon so much in the United States.
Although we have to build a wall.
Of course. Well, there's that huge wall we have to build. But, you know, setting that aside, I mean, there is this sort of obsession with walls, right? And that is one common thread that we see on both sides of the Atlantic. People are much more fixated on what the border should look like than who's coming across it and what to do with those people, whether they're on that side or on this side. But I would say, in terms of a wall, the U.S.-Mexico border is in many ways just as, if not more, militarized than many of the border zones in the outlying western regions or the Mediterranean, for that matter, of continental Europe. There are many reasons for that that have happened over the years. We've just sort of, the border patrol has become increasingly militarized over the years. But it was once a very porous border. And that's important to remember because people for a very long time have been sort of freely flowing between the U.S. and Mexico to work, to raise families. And sometimes the border just really just cuts straight across their communities. And we see that in a lot of border towns. And so that's it's a place where legal boundaries really cut against everyday life.
In Europe, many people come by boat, and I'm surprised we don't see more of that in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, I mean, if you remember the people, the raft and the boat people coming from Cuba, I mean, that was a phenomenon certainly in previous years, and there have been various waves of refugees coming over. Part of the way that's really portrayed in the media depends on what we consider a refugee. If you might recall, there's that wet foot, dry foot rule that governs Cuban immigration. We are rather generous in how we define Cuban refugees of the Castro regime, right? But we don't define people fleeing from Haiti the same way, right? And we certainly don't define, what one huge similarity between us and Europe right now is the wave of Central American refugees that's coming up, and very few of them are able to access asylum as they should.
The patterns change. I read an article today about how people in El Paso are seeing more Cubans coming across the border.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, Mexico has always been a hub. It's been sort of a crossing point. So many of the Central American refugees come through there. But you know what? Like the whole phenomenon of undocumented immigration and forged papers, I mean, that was really a phenomenon of Chinese people crossing through Mexico to get to the United States. And there's been a long history of that. And Mexico has always been a trafficking point. And oftentimes people from Cuba have come up through that border.
Well, there were laws until not all that long ago that prevented Chinese people from coming to the United States.
Yeah, there was
laws that could be called racist.
Yes, and we see some reviving of that kind of ethos percolating up in this election, and that is what I think many people should find alarming. Not just because it involves criminalizing and scapegoating a whole bunch of people who are already here now, but because it is so it harkens back to a very dark history in this country of absolute exclusion of hard borders and of national quotas.
My guest is Michelle Chen. Her article, Undocumented Immigrants Can't Vote, But They're Still Making Their Voices Heard, is in The Nation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Often when we hear complaints about undocumented immigrants and the like, we are told they don't pay taxes, they are takers, they're not givers. But don't many of them pay taxes?
Many of them pay arguably more than their fair share in taxes. I think one of the recent studies that have tried to assess this systematically have come up with the figure of over $11 billion in taxes that just undocumented people pay. So these are the supposed freeloaders, right? The ones who are here completely off the books.
Why are they paying more? I know you wrote a previous article about the ways they contribute to the country.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is paid in sales taxes, so consumption taxes and property taxes. One thing that's often overlooked is that many undocumented people are homeowners or are property owners. They have assets in this country and they pay taxes on that. Oftentimes they may pay taxes actually if they are paying into the Social Security system, they may be on a payroll and they may pay income tax and payroll taxes through that. These are taxes for services that they're funding that they will ultimately, by and large, in many cases, never redeem. And that's one thing to keep in mind, because I think one of the fundamental tenets underlying our Constitution and the founding of this country is no taxation without representation. And what you have here is a huge swath of the population that has no representation but is taxed a whole hell of a lot.
How are they able to own property if they're undocumented? Don't they need some sort of paperwork to prove that they're American citizens?
Citizenship is not a requirement in many property transactions. And if you witness the real estate market here in New York, you might understand that there's been a lot of foreign real estate buying. But I mean, setting that aside, generally speaking, the types of financial dealings that a lot of people have with their day-to-day businesses and their homes and stuff, I mean, the documentation doesn't always work through that. And you can also get a taxpayer ID number, and that will allow you to legally sort of be a known quantity to the IRS, and that can allow you to pay taxes, which is, of course, there's a curious logic behind that, because the federal government does make a provision for taking money and taxes from people who are not citizens, but they're much more stringent about granting citizenship rights.
Although they aren't part of the electorate, they're still part of the public sphere. What are non-citizens doing to affect politics and most specifically, the politics of this election?
They're doing a lot that is basically everything short of voting. So you
engage in lobbying?
You could call it a form of lobbying if that means going to legislators' offices, trying to corral them, in some cases doing sit-ins to get them to talk about legislation. And also just to hold them accountable for promises that they've made, because oftentimes promises have been made to the immigrant community, and even though some of them can't vote, you know, they certainly do believe in holding their leaders accountable, right? And immigrant youth especially have been really active in terms of both pushing on legislators, but also rallying for things like comprehensive immigration reform, tons of rallies, protest marches in the streets, really since 2006. Which is an earlier wave of an attempt at immigration reform in Congress. In this recent election, you see initiatives like Promise Arizona and a variety of Get Out the Vote drives where immigrants have been canvassing. You know, regardless of whether they're citizens or not, many of them may not be able to vote, but they can still convince their neighbors to vote. They can still knock on doors, and they can still make a pretty articulate case in many ways as to why they should support this or that candidate or this or that ballot measure.
Are you surprised by the fact that a number of the children of immigrants who have become politicians in this country seem to be so unsympathetic to the plight of other immigrants?
Yeah, well, I think it gets to this curious notion of kind of a threshold of citizenship and what we determine to go along with citizenship. So is it a certain kind of demonstrated allegiance to your country? Is it a certain kind of cultural assimilation? And I think, and I actually think this is more prevalent for an earlier generation of immigrants where assimilation was key, right? And sort of making sure that you could demonstrate that you were above and beyond, right? That you were a model citizen. And in some cases, sadly, that meant distancing yourself from your background. I think now the new generation of activists, they very much see themselves in solidarity with their parents' generation. And that has a lot to do with the history of immigration in their communities. Many of their communities are much more established. And they have a certain level of autonomy and their own political voice and their own political clout. And the more they can sort of bank on that as their sort of key locus of political power, I think the less maybe they feel pressure to sort of toe the party line, or, you know, often literally the party line of their party in terms of, you know, having this or that stance on border security.
Haven't immigrants had rather low voting turnout records over the years?
It's gone up and down. There are some studies that actually show that naturalized citizens actually vote at a higher rate, or that they're more politically active than you know, native born. Not everyone who's a citizen it does not come from an immigrant background, right? So there's that division there. There are also differences in terms of just political engagement overall. So you can be a naturalized citizen, and you can be an immigrant who is not naturalized, but nonetheless feels very much in tune with the issues.
Well, we saw the situation with the Farm Workers Union, where Cesar Chavez was actually representing some people who weren't U.S. citizens. The gains that were made affected a lot of people, citizens and non-citizens alike. Something similar happened with the tomato workers in Florida recently.
Yeah, I mean, these are all... when you think about the types of struggles that immigrants are going through in this country, they're really symbolic and I think embodying of the struggles that low-wage workers across the country go through. They struggle against racial injustice. There are a lot of intersections now between mass incarceration and aggressive policing in communities and the types of immigration enforcement that is imposed on immigrants. And so they feel all of these struggles that are very much impacting citizens and non-citizens alike. And the more the population is taught to divide itself along these arbitrary lines of citizenship, the weaker the populace becomes.
The division involves many people claiming that immigrants are stealing American jobs. And that's been a complaint that we've heard
since the founding of the country.
America, yeah, since the 19th century.
Right. And it always seems to go in cycles. And the idea that immigrants are here to steal jobs is, of course, a very popular canard in the political sphere. Research generally does not bear that out. And if anything, immigrants are pretty much a net contributor to the economy. So there's a direct correlation between the level of immigration in a certain region and the economic GDP and the growth. And so if immigrants are net contributors to growth, then it's really hard to make the case that they're bad for the economy.
Well, why isn't that case made more forcefully on either side of the aisle?
Well, in case you haven't noticed, in this election season, facts sometimes go out the window and people kind of angle towards what they want to hear. So there is that kind of element of confirmation bias. And there is that element that sometimes the types of economic hardship that people face, and they are real, right, are difficult to understand and difficult to explain. And when you can latch onto a scapegoat, that's a lot easier than, say, untangling all the sinews of the financial crisis and seeing how overproduction and a lopsided economy and economic inequality writ large has really done the working class, no good in this country for a very, very long time. And when you think you can blame it on some foreign other, then often becomes a lot more convenient than explaining, complicated Wall Street debt financing to people.
Michelle Chen's article, Undocumented Immigrants Can't Vote, But They're Still Making Their Voices Heard, is in The Nation. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Michelle Chen. Her article, Undocumented Immigrants Don't Vote, But They're Still Making Their Voices Heard, is in The Nation. And you relied on a study that was conducted for the Russell Sage Foundation Journal of the Social Sciences by James McCann and Michael Jones Correa. What did they find?
They sort of parse the data on what the undocumented and non-citizen population is doing to impact the electorate in ways that are sort of outside of the voting system. So they looked at non-citizen participation in the political process in a variety of ways. So that could be anything from contacting a legislative official to joining a volunteer activity, to signing a petition, to attending a protest. And all sorts of things. I mean, and many of them could perhaps join a civic group or do something that doesn't involve voting per se, but nonetheless gives them an avenue into the political process.
After the last election, it was recommended to the Republican Party that they do things to woo Latino voters, other minority groups. But the tone of the election has been in an opposite direction.
Yeah, they seem to have given up on that.
Have immigrants been working harder during this election to influence the results?
Well, I think immigrants have a lot at stake in this election, even though they can't, that not all of them can vote. I think that there's a lot of disillusionment with the Obama administration's inability to pass meaningful immigration reform at the federal level. And there's also a great deal of concern about an increasingly hostile racial and policing climate against immigrant communities. And that's been going on under a Democratic administration. And so people are pretty worried, not only about the prospect of a Trump presidency, but that the prospect of another Democratic regime is going to mean more of the same. And people don't want to see that. We've already seen record deportations under Obama. So
he's been called the deporter in chief.
Yes.
And yet his administration has been criticized by anti-immigrant groups for not doing enough about illegal immigration.
Yeah, well, I mean, so it goes with when you're the president of a highly polarized nation. You know, part of it is because of Congress's sort of paralysis on this issue. They've been unable to move forward meaningful legislative reform. And there's also been pushback against Obama's executive actions. Because he's been stonewalled in Congress, he has tried to do a lot of things through administrative orders that he couldn't get done in Congress. And that's had its drawbacks. One is that these are executive orders, so that they're very temporary. The other is
that they get brought to court.
Right. They get brought to court and they can get upended at the Supreme Court, as we've seen recently. And it's just a very precarious way for people to live. I mean, to bring this back to what it's like to live in an immigrant community, I mean, imagine you are you came to the country undocumented. You were, through an executive order, able to gain a stay in your deportation that is temporary. You're able to get some work authorization that is also temporary. And meanwhile, your parents, who are also undocumented, have no legal pathway towards long-term resettlement in this country. And so your family continues to be torn. So that is pretty frustrating. While I certainly sympathize with the Obama White House on not being able to get stuff done, I think that, you know, we should think about what it's like to struggle when you're in one of those families.
We're even hearing that from some people that citizenship should be denied children who are born in this country if their parents are undocumented.
Yeah, which is, of course, flying in the face of the Constitution, and is also just seen as a pretty grave sort of, it's been a very long time since the country actually took something like denaturalization seriously or revocation of citizenship seriously. And so to go back to a time when your citizenship could be so easily questioned and repealed, I think goes against some fundamental tenets of what people think American society is. I mean, people, if anything, we have so many different legal statuses in this country. You would think that citizenship would be kind of a great equalizer. Like, once you get to that point, you should be safe. So to think that it could be ripped away from you at any minute just because your parents don't have citizenship, I mean, that we have birthright citizenship in this country. And we've had it for, you know, since basically the Civil War, for a very good reason, because we operate under a democratic system in which we think that blood should not determine your citizenship.
Bernie Sanders' campaign put out an ad that featured a migrant woman working on farm fields in Florida. Did the Sanders campaign promote policies that appear to be more sympathetic toward non-citizens than others? Because he also came out against the idea of open borders.
Right. Well, I think where the Sanders campaign kind of has a through line here, I think, is that he ultimately came to immigrant rights through the lens of labor. And I think that he sees himself as a labor advocate. And to the extent that improving conditions for immigrant workers in this country will improve conditions for workers overall, he believes in that. And I think that's why he was an early champion of the Coalition for Immokalee Workers, which is that group down in Florida that he featured in one of his ads. But he had been campaigning with them for a number of years, supporting their right to fair wages and to better conditions in the field. fields, regardless of citizenship status, regardless of legal status. And I think he's coming at it from the idea that once you are able to set a firm floor for labor rights in this country, for whoever is here working, then that is going to improve conditions for workers overall. To the extent that he was against open borders, I think we need to sort of parse the idea of what people mean by open borders. Often open borders is associated with an idea of sort of free trade or, you know, open borders in terms of commerce, right? And we've seen that also linked in
TPP,
very,
for example.
Yes, in very tricky ways politically, right, to neoliberal trade regimes. And if we think back to NAFTA, we can say that that actually, there's very good evidence now that that hasn't really been good for working people on either side of the border. So until we have a way to sort of match the free flow of capital with the free flow of labor and match labor rights up with the rights of businesses to export and import as they will, then we're going to have problems in terms of human rights.
But you mentioned that Sanders was reflecting the attitudes of unions. Haven't unions often been anti-immigration?
They have sometimes
seen
historically.
Immigrants as being the competition?
Yeah, I mean, and it goes back to this idea of, you know, whether what approach unions take, right? If they are seeking solidarity, if they're seeking the greatest sort of strength in numbers, then it would kind of make sense for them to unite immigrant and native-born workers, regardless of what their legal status is, so that they can fight, you know, the boss, right? And oftentimes, and we've seen that coming through in the labor movement in recent years, I think because the labor movement has dwindled to such an extent, and to the extent that that has also coincided with a huge influx in immigration, then it only makes sense to see where the newest sort of waves of the growing workforce are coming from. The new working class is the immigrants, right? And so if we can't get them unionized, if we continue to exclude them, then the unionized population of workers in this country will eventually dwindle to nothing. And then you have no representation of labor whatsoever.
I think we're all familiar with Donald Trump's ideas about immigration policy, but what about Hillary Clinton's? What has she said?
Yeah, I mean, she's sort of, for now, she's vowed to continue in some form the types of immigration relief that Obama extended to undocumented youth, and wants to maybe broaden that further to the parents of undocumented parents. And so, you know, that could offer some at least temporary relief for undocumented adults and children in some circumstances. It still wouldn't get at a very large portion of the undocumented population here. The things that she has sort of thrown out there on the campaign trail are things like shutting down private detention centers, which have become a symbol of kind of the draconian enforcement measures of Department of Homeland Security. She's said much less generally about what people want to see going forward in terms of future flows of immigration. So the so-called question of, you know, guest workers, what should be our border policy going forward? How should workers be invited in or be allowed in the future when they want to come? So she's said some things about dealing with the population already here. None of that has been very satisfying to the more radical immigrant rights groups. And overall, I think people want consistency and they want leaders who can keep promises.
At the Democratic National Convention, a dreamer named Astrid Silva spoke about her family's plight. How was she able to speak at that major convention and not be subject to an inquiry from Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, the Department of Homeland Security is to rush up on stage in the middle of the GNC and nab her right then and there. I mean, I think that there are many gradients of social control and surveillance that immigrants live under. And oftentimes, you know, if you're not directly targeted for deportation, and I'm not saying that's not a very real danger for a lot of people in this country, you know, undocumented youth in particular, they do have certain protections. They have access to public school. In many cases, cases, they have access to some basic clinical health care services. So it's not the Trump scenario that we're seeing right now where, he has these grand visions of, midnight raids and just sort of sweeping up people and kicking them across over the border overnight. So people don't live in that kind of fear, but nonetheless, the fear is very real. And a lot of it comes down to how local immigration is enforced and oftentimes how much the immigration authorities collude with local police. So if you're being hassled and stopped in traffic all the time by your local police, that could very easily sweep you into federal custody.
Now, most of the focus has been on Latino immigrants. Have other groups been affected as well?
Latino immigrants are a huge and growing population in this country, both citizen and non-citizen, and they're one of the fastest growing components of the electorate or soon to be electorate. But Asian immigration has soared, and it's actually, I think in some case, by some measures, it's accelerating, it's growing faster than the Latino population by some measures in terms of just who is coming in, new immigration.
But people haven't complained as much because Asians are seen as the model immigrant group.
Yeah, right. I mean, and of course it has to do with not only demographics, but also the types of jobs people are taking as they come in, whether or not they're coming in over the border versus on a visa of some sort. We have these different classes of skills that workers come in on. So you might see, a lot of South Asian immigration coming in through special tech visas, for instance. And so that's another way to come. Race and class does definitely shade into perceptions of immigrants. But also, I think often, we don't realize that it really depends on the community. Because if you go down to the border, you see people who have been living alongside Mexican Americans for generations, and they don't see things in terms of who's a citizen and who isn't.
Just one more thing, because we don't have much time, but sanctuary cities have been under attack, especially during the Republican primary. Are people being deported from those cities?
Well, it's not – the sanctuary city idea is set up to sort of offer this idea of a safe space, the idea of a safe city to be in if you are undocumented, meaning that local law enforcement will not interfere with you and will not arbitrarily arrest you or detain you. And so that is what sanctuary means. They're not being deported. They're being protected explicitly. That's the main difference.
Michelle Chen's article, Undocumented Immigrants Can't Vote, But They're Still Making Their Voices Heard, is in The Nation. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me.